Hello. In this audio snippet, we would like to talk about several things that have been going on at the time of this recording, going through some headlines. We would like to talk about other things and more or less finish out the things we have been wanting to talk about regarding America, especially now that it's dead. It feels like it's time to move on, but for some reason, I feel this need to share these things and to emphasize certain concepts and to point out how they are relevant in the context of everything going on at the time of this recording. We'll go to several headlines and share some thoughts. A lot of these things may seem miscellaneous, but I believe they can be grouped. And there are one or two common themes throughout all these quote miscellaneous headlines we'll be sharing. So the first one is from a left-wing website called Politico. It's a more or less disgusting website. Anything that is posted on Politico is usually not to be trusted. But the reason why we want to briefly mention the article is just to point out what's going on. So the headline says, "How will the speaker mess get sorted out? Here are four scenarios." And then I'm just going to read the first paragraph and not really go much further because I don't want to read too much from this left-wing website. But the article was posted on the 19th of October, 2023, and written by some Anthony fellow. And it says at the beginning, "House Republicans are as paralyzed as ever in their quest for a new speaker. Jim Jordan's all but done, even if he won't formally bow out. There is no alternative waiting in the wings, who'd clearly have a better shot at 217 votes. And one idea that seemed plausible a few hours ago, cutting a deal with Democrats to make Patrick McHenry acting speaker, was panned Thursday during a meeting of GOP lawmakers." And then it says, "So where do House Republicans go from here? How will this intractable mess eventually get sorted out?" So at the time of this recording, the House is trying to elect a speaker, and they had nominated Jim Jordan, the Republicans. And Jim Jordan is, if I'm not mistaken, endorsed by Trump. But it hasn't happened because there's some people who are opposed to him. And so the reason why I mentioned this article is just to highlight how in the midst of this what they call mess, no one at any point is questioning why do we need a speaker to run things in the House. And oh, some people say, well, that's the procedure. He is the one who, he or she is the one who appoints committees or does all these things and decides on a lot of issues. But it goes back to the fundamental problem that we have mentioned a million times in previous recordings, that the Speaker of the House position, it is a stupidity. I know it's in the Constitution, which doesn't validate it. But just because it's in the Constitution doesn't mean that it was right. I know that's a shocker of a concept for conservatives to absorb, but the reality is that speakership position is just a power clot. It's not necessary. And it was created there because of the spirit of elitism that dominated the founding fathers' thinking. They wanted as conservatives say over and over again, they wanted a republic, not a democracy. And that meant that the republic had structures of elitism that protected the nation from the mobbery, if that's a an actual word of democracy. They didn't want people to run amok. The democratic process, having all this mob of people controlling things and throwing things into chaos. So they always felt the need to add this elitist layer of protection to save us from ourselves, basically. That's why they have the Electoral College. Instead of having a regular national popular vote, it's the Electoral College system, because the Electoral College is a way for the electors to change their mind and maybe change their vote at the last second to override the craziness of the people. So when they talked about the founding fathers, about we the people, they really didn't mean it. You know, they weren't really that interested in we the people having control. It was always we the people, but with the supervision of some elite who will control the passions of the mob. And as we've said before, a lot of conservatives actually argue that the phrase "we the people" is actually a reference to the states. So the people are not the individual Americans. It's the state of Virginia, the state of Maryland, the state of whatever, and not the actual individual people. And because they had this elitist mindset, they created the speakership position. Instead of allowing a democratic flow or an organic flow, they wanted someone to control things. And it's ironic because the people who are elected to the House, you would think, are people who are not just crazy, the crazy average American. It's somebody who has been elected and who supposedly has some gray matter inside you know, that skull that they carry around. So you would think that they should be trusted, or that they are worthy of being trusted in not going crazy. But no, they needed a Speaker of the House, because the idea of a they did it with the House and not so much with the Senate, because the House has more people in it, and it is a more direct representation of the population, as opposed to the Senate, where two people per state. And at the beginning, those two people were elected not by the people, but by the state legislature. So they already had like a layer of elitist covering. And that's why the founding fathers were not as concerned about the Senate and more concerned about the House, because the House was a more direct representation of democratic will. They represented the will of the people in a more direct way than the Senate. And that's why this mob of representatives needed some elite guy, and that was the Speaker of the House. But if things were run organically, and especially now that we have the technology to where, you know, anybody could post a bill, and then all the other people could look at it and give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and if it reached a certain level of thumbs up, then it would become eligible to be voted on the floor. So it'd go into this queue, you know, first in, first out, on a first in, first out basis. It would go into the queue and get voted on along with the other votes. So there's no need for someone to decide, oh yeah, this one can be voted on, this one goes to this committee. Nothing like that. It could have been very organic, and then it would have been a matter of evangelism. If you're a congressman, you have a great idea, you have a bill, you post it, and then you go from door to door to talk to all your fellow congressmen and congresswomen. Just tell them, hey, I have this great idea. Do you want to talk about it? We can get together in the Congress cafeteria and we can talk about it. or they can, you know, borrow a room, a conference room somewhere. I don't know if they have conference rooms in the capital, and reserve a room, and they get together, you know, Ronnie, Bobby, Ricky, and Mike get together and go to this conference room and talk it out. That sort of thing, dynamically. It doesn't have to be a committee appointed by some speaker or anything like that. It's a democratic process. And in the midst of all this craziness, you would think somebody would say, okay, you know, guys, there's something wrong with this whole thing. Why do we need a Speaker of the House to run things when we can do it organically? And maybe just have somebody who, we described this in detail in previous audio recordings, have a House referee, an HR, who is more or less doesn't have powers, just he's doing traffic control, maybe in the sense of enforcing very objective rules on the bills being proposed. Because we talked about, like, for example, one of the rules being that no bill can be more than, and I'm just saying a number, 10 or 15 pages long. And that every bill has to be on a specific topic. It cannot be a hodgepodge of things, because that's what leads to all this pork where, I'll vote for this if you put in money for a bridge to nowhere in my district. And all these things that are unrelated get jammed into bills, and that's how we get the chaos that we have. So, you know, someone who's just applying very objective rules to validate that the bills are okay and so forth, and who maybe does some sort of housekeeping and that sort of thing. We talked about, for example, where if a Congress causes a budget deficit by and which leads to a need for a loan to cover that deficit, then that loan will be associated to that Congress, and everybody who participated in that Congress will have to pay from their salary a penalty for having produced a deficit that forced the country to borrow money to cover that deficit. And it would be that penalty would be in proportion to the loan, to the amount of the loan, and it would be and they would get penalties also for the interest applied on that loan. They would get penalized for every year that loan has not been paid, and even after they leave Congress, they would continue to pay the penalty, even in their private practice, in their private lives. Why? Because they left Congress, they left us with a debt that we're still paying for. And because of that, they need to be penalized even if they're no longer in Congress. These are the things that would have been in the new American Constitution, the things that would have come to our minds, our collective minds, if we were had been willing to listen to the truth, because the truth was saying all of these things. So, but in the midst of all this craziness, instead of saying, okay, we need to have a paradigm shift, there's something not right with the whole system. No, we're still full throttle, just going down the same road, even in the midst of this chaos, and no one wakes up. And then this becomes an opportunity. See, the thing is, with the power clot situation, then we have a condition where you can never really affect real change, because there's always going to be somebody there who is going to try to please the party and please the people enough to get, you know, reelected, instead of someone who can act on principle. And that's why they're having so much trouble. There's no one who has principle enough to lead. And then everybody has to settle. Jim Jordan is a rhino light. Yes, he sounds conservative in some things and all that. And conservatives get all aroused when they hear certain things that he says. But at the end of the day, he is a... he is a rhino, a light version of a rhino. When McCarthy, Kevin McCarthy, the guy who got kicked out because he was clearly a sellout Republican, Jim Jordan was upset. He said Kevin McCarthy was doing a great job. He was praising Kevin McCarthy, the outgoing guy. And then they decide to put him, a guy who was praising the guy who was being kicked out and criticized, and he's now the option. Do you see the stupidity of this? And no one goes, oh, there's something wrong here, because why don't we have someone we can pick that we can trust? And why aren't people choosing Matt Gaetz, the guy who instigated the ouster of Kevin McCarthy? Why isn't Trump, who is supposedly this champion of that will save America, why didn't he endorse Matt Gaetz? Why? Because the party leaders don't, the leadership of the party does not care much for Matt Gaetz. So Trump, who wants to ingratiate himself with the RNC, the Republican National Committee, will never try to promote someone who is completely opposed to their agenda. So the system just continues, and it's a disaster, full of power clots, and no one is thinking anything. You know, it's like we're living in this fantasy world. So the other story that we wanted to mention related to this is on the Gateway Pundit, the website that we refer to a great deal, and it's a story posted on the 20th of October, the day before this recording is posted. And it says, breaking, rhinos win House GOP votes in secret ballot to boot Jim Jordan for Speaker by large margin, 112-86, candidate forum to be held Monday. So after they tried to get him elected, eventually, apparently, there was a secret ballot, and they booted Jim Jordan from being a candidate for Speaker. But the reason why I want to mention this headline is that it says rhinos win. So to these conservatives, you know, from the Gateway Pundit, Jim Jordan is the conservative answer, and not electing him means that the rhinos, the Republicans name only, have won. But how can that be when this Jim Jordan was in favor of the Kevin McCarthy, and who said Kevin McCarthy is doing a great job, and Kevin McCarthy was a rhino? If he's supporting a rhino, doesn't that make him a rhino by association? So how can then they say that the rhinos won when he did not become Speaker? See the ridiculous nature of this. And Jim Jordan, he's a great talker. Oh yes, he does. He says all these wonderful things every now and then. Doesn't say that much, but that's that excellent. But it sounds good if you listen to it on the surface. But that's all he is, talk, talk, talk. He has never really proposed real legislation in Congress to really change things. He sits on these hearings and he asks all these tough questions to all these witnesses. And he supposedly, you know, asked these cutting questions, and everybody goes, ooh, ah. But what's the point of that? It's just pomp and circumstance. That's all it is. You know, show me the money. That's what I would say. Show me the bills. And I don't mean the dollar bills. I mean the legislative bills. Show me the bills that you have proposed to really do things. You criticize people. When have you promoted a bill to indict or condemn and punish the people that you so bravely question in your hearings? You know, so it's people living in fantasy land. Why are these conservatives now pro Jim Jordan? Because Trump said so. And why did Trump say so? because Jim Jordan is the best choice in this pool of rhino filth that is just good enough to be vaguely supported by the RNC, at least in this on the surface. And Trump wants to get along with the RNC because that's important for him to continue with his art of the deal and, you know, making America great again. So that's where we are. And another story, speaking of Trump, is try to get to it here. So let me just apologize here. All right. So the next story here is posted on the 20th of October, 2023, and it says, breaking, again on the Gateway Pundit, breaking, leftist NYC Judge Engoron threatens to jail President Donald Trump for leaving a post up on his social media page. So they're trying to silence Trump, and they're using the gag order methodology to silence him politically. And the reason why I'm mentioning this is every time I read about the gag order and all that stuff, I mean, everybody complains, and I understand, you know, they are using this as a political weapon to silence political opponents, you know, just like in a banana republic, because America is now a third world country. It died on the 6th of September of 2023. It's a third world country now. So that doesn't surprise me. But in the midst of this, I go, why hasn't anybody said to themselves, why does a judge have the power to issue a gag order to begin with, in general, not just for Trump or for, you know, for certain people? Why can a judge issue a gag order? Where did that come from? Where's that in the Constitution? Where's that in the system? And, you know, and the reason why you can't find it in the Constitution is because the Founding Fathers, as we've said a million times, were so vague and so unclear about the role of the judiciary that the judiciary became anything we wanted it to be. That's what, and if people, the strict constitutionalists said, oh, we should just go by what's in the Constitution, and if the Constitution does not say it, then we can't do it. Then there'd be no judiciary branch at all, because it'd be powerless. There's almost nothing there in the Constitution to clarify what they can or cannot do. If we go just by what they can explicitly do according to the Constitution, then judges would be powerless. So then we have to ad lib, and no one said, okay, we have to put a fence around this thing and figure out what the limitations and the powers of this branch are all about. And we had Marbury versus Madison, which we mentioned over and over again. The Founding Fathers were involved. Madison was involved, one of the Founding Fathers in that case. And even then, they didn't say, okay, this is a wake-up call. We need to sort this out before it gets out of hand. So who decides that these judges can have all this power? They're like gods in their courtroom. And they can say, oh, I hold you in contempt. I do this and do that, do the other. And they have the power to put people in jail based on their whim, and they are like drunken, they're drunk with power. They're like gods in their courtroom. And who gave them the authority to issue gag orders? What legislation in American history said judges have the authority to issue gag orders, and under what conditions? There is nothing. So a judge can just, you know, pull it, you know, go to the bathroom and come out. Oh yeah, I just produced the justification for a gag order, and he shows what he got from the bathroom and say, yeah, here it is. Now this is my justification for telling you you can't say anything. And no one can question it because there's no bill to go to say, okay, a gag order is valid if this, this, and this, and that. There's nothing. There's no procedure because, see, judges were supposed to be referees. That's all they were supposed to be. A referee does not make up stuff. A referee does not say, oh, you know what? I don't like you. I'm going to eject you and give you a red card. Why, judge? I don't know. I just don't like you. You know, you have an attitude problem. And so you didn't bow to me when you entered the field. So I'm just going to kick you out. And here you go. Red card. Get out of here. A referee cannot do that. He can only enforce, strictly enforce the rules that he was given to enforce. And judges don't have that. They are gods. They're arrogant sons of bitches and whores, the vast majority of them in the American system. And they do whatever the hell they want. Pardon my French, but that's the reality. And why? Because the moron founding fathers never decided to put limits on it. So as all of this is happening, everybody's, pardon my French again, bitching and moaning, complaining about all these things. And no one says, no one goes to the truth and says, truth, what is going on? Why are we doing all of this? What are we doing wrong here? No one is doing that. So no one goes to the root of the problem. No one goes, okay, where does this concept of a gag order come from? What is the validation? What is the foundation in our system to enable judges to issue gag orders? And I'm using gag orders as an example of the many things that you wonder, why can a judge do that? And they issue these strange rules. They force people to do certain things. And you go, where did that come from? Well, they are drunk with power. They're drunk with power because the constitutional system that was left behind by the founding fathers never delimited their power. It never said what they can or cannot do in truth. And we in America are not listening to the truth. The truth was speaking this whole time. Now the truth has, you know, declared us dead. We are dead as a nation. America is dead. So, but it's astounding. You know, you see all of this and no one seems to be waking up. Article that we wanted to make a quick reference to. It's on the Gateway Pundit again, posted on the 20th of October, 2023. And the headline says, breaking, all 8 hero Republicans who voted to remove McCarthy from speakership are, quote, prepared to accept censure, suspension, or removal from the Republican conference in return for Representative Jim Jordan being elected speaker. The reason why we want to mention this is, you know, the article kind of portrays them as these heroes and they're being self-sacrificial. And yes, you could say yes, they're being self-sacrificial, but there's a certain stupidity in their whole self-sacrificial behavior. And let me just read I wanted to read to you something that when I read it was like so sad, so sad. So yes, here it is. They're quoting here, we remain proud members of the Republican Party as nominated by our respective districts, unquote, they affirm. The statement concludes with a plea for unity among Republicans, emphasizing that what unites them is more important than their disagreements. Quote, we must now come together to elect Jim Jordan. We offer this sincerely and with the hope of unity with purpose. Our fidelity to Republican virtues and principles remains unwavering, unquote. And this statement of these 8 people includes Matt Gaetz, the main ringleader of the instigation, you know, that led to the ouster of Kevin, or what's his name, McCarthy. And Matt Gaetz, I kind of admire him to a certain extent, and then I pity him. You know, as someone would say, I pity the fool, because I pity the naive fool, because does he really think that the people at the Republican National Committee, the chairmanship, you know, all the people in control of the Republican Party, like Matt Gaetz, doesn't he realize that if they, at the first chance they have to destroy him and destroy his career, that they will not hesitate to take advantage of that chance? Doesn't he realize that he's not wanted? Because I've said to myself, why in the world, if Matt Gaetz, you know, is such a brave conservative and blah, 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 why didn't Trump endorse him? Why didn't Trump say, okay, I don't want a rhino, I don't want a Jim Jordan, I want someone who really wants change, someone who's brave and has courage. Obviously he didn't endorse Matt Gaetz or even want to do that, because Matt Gaetz is not in the radar of the Republican National Committee, and he wants to, you know, he wants to kiss some buttocks, because he thinks it's part of the art of the deal to make America great again and blah, blah, blah. But this Matt Gaetz is defending the Republican Party. And we've said in these recordings over and over again how the Republican Party died. And we started going, you know, into the 1800s and the Civil War period and post-Civil War and the election of 1876. We talked about all these things, how the Republican Party died or died to its calling, to the point that it was born to save to defend the rights of black people. That was the foundation of the Republican Party, and it lost it, and it became the party about nothing, the party that didn't really stand for anything relevant, and it died to its original cause. So in the midst of this, all of this is just bearing that out. When they got the election stolen from them in 2020, the Republican Party did nothing. It's the party, it's the do-nothing party. It's the party about nothingness. And in the midst of all of this, instead of saying, okay, there's something wrong with this party, there's something fundamentally wrong with this party, and we need to redefine it, we need to or realize what is wrong with this, instead of that, they are pledging their allegiance to a party that hates them. These eight people are pledging allegiance. They're saying, we're proud Republicans. And on top of that, it's not just a matter of reforming the Republican Party, it's ending the party system, full stop, as we've described a million times in previous recordings. It's a matter of castrating the party system. People should not be elected as a member of a party. They should be elected on their own merit. And the reason why and you know who started the party system? Madison. James Madison was the one who started the party system. One of the founding fathers. He started the he said, we don't want parties. He kept saying in the Federalist Papers, we don't want factions to arise because that creates problems and so forth. And then a few years later, after the Republic was born, was established officially and all that, then he starts the party. And then you have the party of the Federalists and the party of the Democrat Republicans. And that's how the party system started. So it's one of the morons at the start who did this. And then it's just grew and grew into the party system that we have, it that's full of power clots. And the party, you know, that's why it's so important who gets the majority, because whoever gets the majority gets all the power positions, decides all the committees, and then decides who the speaker is and so forth. And then and then the speaker is constantly hearing what the republic, what the party chairmanship says behind the scenes. People who are not elected, who are influencing him or her, telling him or her, you know, you do our bidding, and we're going to help you get reelected. We're going to give you more power, and you may even run for president one day, and we're going to be supporting you. So all of this, quid pro quo that starts happening because of the party system. And in the midst of all this mess, in the midst of these eight people who are being, who will be slaughtered in the altar, at the altar of the public, of the party system, they're still pledging allegiance to that party system. And the party system wants them dead, and they still say, no, we pledge our allegiance to the party system. That's why the country's dead. It is just mind-boggling, the level of blindness, even from the people who are supposed to have eyesight. So now they're willing to sacrifice themselves and be censured or whatever, just so that a rhino, a half rhino, Jim Jordan, who supported the guy that they worked so hard to oust, so that guy can get elected to the speakership. What? The next story we want to share on, and I think this one epitomizes and summarizes all the other things that we have been saying in this recording. And it's an article, again, posted on the Gateway Pundit on the 20th of October, kind of an eventful day, apparently. And the article is, it says, Wayne Root, finally, some good news, quote, the Great Awakening, unquote, and, quote, the Great American Divorce, unquote, are converging. The debate is over. We won. So this is Wayne Root. And by the way, he's a conservative Jew. So it's interesting in the context of things happening, because that's the second part of what we want to talk about. It has to do with Israel. So he's a conservative and a Jew. And this guy, I've seen him before. He's apparently very popular, or very well liked in the conservative circles. But every time I see him, he has this smile, and it's kind of like a naive smile, like someone who, it's like someone who's high on some medication, and it's just happy. Because there's like a disconnect with reality, and he's always like this positive, cheery fellow, and yeah, there's nothing wrong with being positive or cheery per se, but it's like being positive and cheery in a funeral, it's kind of like it shows a bit of a disconnect between what's around the person and and your state of mind. So he's saying the Great Awakening. He's talking about the Great Awakening. So he starts explaining how the American people are not buying it anymore, and that he gives his supposed arguments for it, that they don't like Bite Me anymore, and he says only 2% of Americans have taken the new lethal injection, the so-called, vaccine, 2%. And that's proof that, oh yes, no one trusts government or the mainstream media anymore. And really, I'm sorry, what fantasy world are you in? So he's saying, we're winning. The country died on the 6th of September, and the death finalized on the 18th, and we became brain dead on the 8th of September. Those are the three kind of like milestone dates, you could say, in that 13-day death period, the 6th, the 8th, and the 18th. He's saying, we're winning. The American people see Democrat policies as a cancer that's killing America. And American exceptionalism. Really? 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 Yeah, I know a few are, but to make it like this bold statement, like generic statement, the American people see Democrat policy, really. And the people have woken up, and the great American divorce that I predicted almost 20 years ago is happening. And the more Democrats talk and govern, the more Americans see the results, and the more Americans choose to run for their lives. And he's talking about people migrating from blue states to red states. He doesn't understand that a lot of people are just fleeing the consequences of blueness, but a lot of them don't end their allegiance to blueness, and they go to red states and turn them purple and eventually blue. No, understand. And then he talks about the polls and how all the polls show that Trump is winning in all the major state, all the major swing states and all this and so forth. So we're winning. And I laugh when I hear about the polls because, and I'm not saying that the polls are not valid or that they're not accurate. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, how can you be excited about a poll in a system where the votes don't count anymore? Where the other side just has to stuff enough ballots, mail-in ballots, in those, bins outside that are standing outside. You just have to stuff enough ballots in or sneak enough in, you know, through the back door as they did in Michigan and other places, or take them out of a suitcase the way they did in Georgia, in Fulton County, to win. That's all they need to do. Why does a poll matter? In third world countries, you know, people don't do polling, especially in banana republics, because you do polling and it's everybody just laughs at you. If you say, oh, the polls show that so-and-so is winning, everybody laughs at you because they know deep inside that their vote doesn't count. They do sometimes they go and do the ceremony of voting, but deep inside they know, I think eventually someone who has already been decided will win. And so polls are irrelevant. They used to be relevant in America because we really did have a partially democratic system, but not anymore. So he's all excited about the polls and all that. And then at the end, at the very end of the article, he asks, now the only question is, will 2024 be rigged? Do the votes matter anymore? And I go, that's like putting the cart before the horse. That's the question you should ask first before getting all excited about the polls. So, as I read these stories, and I think that's kind of the theme in all these headlines. You know what I hear when I see these headlines? I see a tattoo looking up and saying, the plane, boss, the plane. And if you live in America, you may know what I'm talking about, or if you're old enough, there used to be a show back in the late 70s and into the early to mid 80s called Fantasy Island. And it starred this fellow of Spanish descent who was born in Mexico. Very good actor, by the way. Ricardo Montalban, that was his name. Very good actor. And there was this short fellow who was called Tattoo on the show, and it was and the name of the show was Fantasy Island, and the story was that the idea of the show was that people would travel, pay like a significant fee to go to this fantasy island and stay there and have their fantasies fulfilled. They had like a dream that I want to be a rock star, and so they go to Fantasy Island, pay whatever hefty fee they had to pay. I don't think they ever said how much it was, but they would pay this fee, and Ricardo Montalban would set things up so that they could be rock stars and live their fantasy. That's what we're living in right now. These people are living in Fantasy Island. I mean, every time they look up, they go, the plane, boss, the plane. Because every little sign of hope, and they go get all excited, and then they go into their fantasy, thinking that everything is all right. people completely detached from reality. And all these stories that we just went through, it's the same theme. People completely detached from reality and not aware of not analyzing what's going on. So those were the first few stories that we wanted to talk about. And the second mini set of things have to do with a different topic, but I do believe there's a linkage. This story drew my attention for several reasons. It's another headline on thegatewaypundit.com. It was posted on the 19th of October, 2023, by a fellow named Brian Lupo, I think. So the headline says, 136 journalists, scientists, intellectuals, and others sign, quote, Westminster Declaration, unquote, for free speech. So then the article starts talking about, you know, how our the freedom of speech has been curtailed in these last few years, and the censorship and all that stuff that many of you may already know about. So it's not worth going into all the detail they mentioned here. Let me just read one paragraph here. It says, now a group of 136 journalists, intellectuals, scientists, and others have signed the Westminster Declaration, which calls on government to uphold the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and to refrain from censoring politically motivated speech, dissenting voices, and political opinion. And signers include journalists Matt Taibbi, if that's how you pronounce it, and Michael Schellenberger, WikiLeaks' Julian Assange, actor Tim Robbins, whistleblower Edward Snowden, Jordan Peterson, and Professor Jay Bhattacharya. And I'm sorry if I'm butchering the surname, but I'm not sure how to pronounce it, so I'm sorry about that. The thing is that it's this declaration to promote free speech, and it's one of the 136 includes Julian Assange, and I think it also includes his wife and so forth. But the reason why I wanted to mention this is for two reasons. One, the name of it drew my attention. When I look at the list, a lot of the people are they're from all over from several countries, mostly the U.S. and the U.K. A few from Canada. I think there's one from Australia. And let's see here. There's one here from the Netherlands, someone from Germany, a couple of journalists from Brazil, even someone from Spain and Germany, and New Zealand, and so forth. But there's a lot of UK people, UK, 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 and US, but as you go down the list, it's UK, 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 and Italy too, and even one from Israel, and that's it. So the thing is that all these people got together, did this declaration, but what drew my attention is the name of it, Westminster Declaration. And the reason why I'm saying that is that if you have listened to these recordings, you may recall that in one of them, I shared that my hope is for one day, I believe it's in one of the recordings, unless I was talking to someone and saying this, but now that my heart is intent on leaving America because America's dead. It's ironic because these people are, you know, people who go to Fantasy Island, you know, to get their fantasies fulfilled. They would go to Fantasy Island. I'm trying to get away from Fantasy Island because I don't want to live in fantasy land where people are completely detached from reality. So instead of arriving in Fantasy Island, I'm trying to get out of here. So the thing is that my hope is maybe I will be allowed to live in the UK. And as I thought about living in the UK or wherever I end up, but when I think of the UK in particular, I see the first thing I saw is myself standing on Westminster Bridge, and speaking out about the need for Britain to embrace freedom of speech, because it's being curtailed. Like for example, you can't even stand and silently pray in front of an abortion clinic, even if you're not doing anything. You're just standing there. You're not protesting, no picket sign, no nothing. You're not talking to anyone. Just standing there praying on your own. The thought police comes and says, "What are your thoughts?" And your thoughts are criminal, and you'll go to jail. And people, you know, being put in jail for what they're wearing on their T-shirts and things like that. It's a violation of the freedom of speech. And maybe in America, even though the freedom of speech is, you know, was maybe limited and now it's dying, at least in America, we had a greater tradition of protecting that right than in the UK. And that's one of the things that I would be doing. I just saw myself just standing on Westminster Bridge because I've been there, and when I just saw myself there again, and with the Westminster Palace to my left, and me just talking, just saying things that, you know, calling the British people to uphold the freedom of speech again, because in a sense it is an English idea. It evolved from English thought, I would dare say. Well, it's actually from the truth, but I'm saying the manifestation of it in our civilization, I think, started in England, I would dare say. And then it kind of got ported to America, and I'll say that with air quotes, it blossomed in America to a certain extent. But now it needs to be revived and restored. And fully upheld as a human right, as part of the right to life, in the UK. And I saw myself on the Westminster Bridge, which is right next, you know, right over the Thames, and right near Westminster Palace, you know, where Parliament meets. And that's what I saw. And I saw myself standing there, just talking and speaking as to people as they were passing by, and maybe handing pamphlets or something. I don't know. I just saw myself doing that, and I find it interesting that then suddenly there's this declaration from Westminster, and I was on Westminster Bridge, in my mind, doing this thing, telling the British people you need to embrace freedom of speech. And that that tells you, and this is to share about the power of your thoughts. If you're connected to the truth and you start speaking in the truth, even if no one is hearing you, they are hearing you, if you catch my drift. And these people heard enough to do this declaration and call it the Westminster Declaration, because in my mind I was declaring the importance of freedom of speech from Westminster Bridge. I could just see myself just standing there one sunny afternoon with around 5 or 6 p.m. I don't know why, with the Westminster Palace to my left, and I'm basically also doing that as a symbolic thing of telling Parliament, hey, you need to pass legislation to uphold the right, the freedom of speech in the UK. And 136 is also an interesting number, because it's 17 times 8. 8 is the number of regeneration. 17 is the number of a manifested revival, or a manifested group of people speaking the truth, being manifested and allowed power to flow and grow. So I know it's not a coincidence that that's the number of people in that group. So I just wanted to mention that. And the other thing is, these people are doing the declaration, the Westminster Declaration, which is non-binding, it's just, you know, a group of people just saying it's important to have freedom of speech. But the sad thing is, all these Jim Jordans, the Matt Gaetz, and everybody who are in power here in America, no one is. Why is no one passing legislation to protect freedom of speech and to criminalize censorship? And to, when Trump was in power, people kept telling him, you need to do something to end the censorship in the mainstream media. And he just laughed it off. He just kept just kicking the tin, you know, the can down the road and never doing anything about it. And he finally got upset with it when he was the one being censored. The moment he got censored, then, oh, the media are shutting people up and not letting people speak. Well, yeah, they weren't letting people speak for quite a while, dude. It's only when it happened to you that it suddenly became important. He had the power. He was in the White House. He was the quote, president, the person officially in power, and he didn't do a thing during his 4 years. He didn't do a thing. He acted like he was, but he wasn't. He never did anything effective. And all the people who had the opportunity to do something didn't. And all these Jim Jordans, everybody who are just living in fantasy land and doing their party game, none of them have really been, you know, serious about doing a doing something and speaking of that, you know, all these January 6th people who are being indicted, politically persecuted. Now you if you do something that is contrary to what the party in power wants, they will use the judicial system to go after you and destroy you. That's political persecution, banana republic stuff. And why isn't Matt Gaetz, why isn't aren't all these people passing legislation to nullify the January 6th convictions, the Republicans? No one is doing any of that. Why isn't Trump? Why Trump promoted Kevin McCarthy? Why didn't and he got promoted because of the support of Trump to the speakership? Why didn't that? Why wasn't Trump on his case day and night, calling him, telling him, "Hey, man, I you know, art of the deal. I did this for you. Now you should do something, pass legislation to nullify all this non-judicial nonsense that's being enacted against the January 6th." People, because the January 6th people were in a demonstration. That's what they were doing, a demonstration, a Tea Party type demonstration. And then there were some people who started instigating trouble, who were inserted to cause trouble by the Democrats. And then the baiting, you know, opening the doors to let them in so that they could then call them insurrectionists. If they really wanted an insurrection, that's the most stupid insurrection ever. If you really wanted to take over the Capitol building and force something, you don't do it with moms and grandmothers and people. I mean, that's the most moronic accusation, you know, when they label them as trying to force a coup d'etat, for crying out loud. Why aren't Matt Gaetz, Jim Jordan, Kevin McCarthy, and all these people, why aren't they passing legislation to end this nonsense? And all we can do is, you know, pass declarations like the Westminster Declaration from people who are not, you know, in positions of power, when the people who are in quote positions of power have the ability to do it, but they don't want to. They don't have the will to do it. And speaking of freedom of speech, the other thing that we wanted to share is this quick story on the Daily Mail, posted on the 20th of October. And it says, conspiracy theorist Alex Jones must still pay $1 billion, with a B, dollars in damages to Sandy Hook families and can't hide behind his bankruptcy protection. Judge rules. See, we were talking about the judges, you know, saying whatever they want and applying the rules the way they feel like it. This Alex Jones said something. Sandy Hook was this place where there was this mass shooting or something, and Alex Jones said something that the families didn't like, and that they sued him. and they got $1 billion. He just said something, and then I think he retracted it a couple of days later. And then this other thing that we've talked about, these juries who hand out, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in penalties in all these trials, and they pull these dollar amounts out of their butts. I mean, why $1 billion, $1,000 million? So, and that's something. That's another thing. Another of the many loose ends in this American Republic, American nation that died in September of this year, 2023. Why did we allow the juries to do that sort of thing? There's no parameter. There's no nothing. So, and because it's not their money, you know, if they don't like the guy, then they can go after him with gusto, and no one can defend the guy like Alex Jones. He has nowhere to go to in this American system that was left behind by the founding fathers that he, Alex Jones, worships. He's one of those founding father worshipers. But in that system that he worships, there's nothing he can do about it. And a judge can just say, yes, you have to pay $1 billion. And why? Because he said something that some people didn't like. The freedom of speech, you know, being totally obliterated. What is Matt Gaetz doing about that? Why isn't Matt, and I'm sorry for picking on Matt Gaetz, but he's supposedly the closest to the truth. Why isn't Jim Jordan? Why isn't Trump? Why wasn't Trump, when he was in power, promoting the idea of let's pass legislation to protect people's right to speak, and not be subject to this sort of abuse? And I'm not a fan of Alex Jones by any stretch of the imagination. He's another guy on Fantasy Island, worshiping the founding fathers and the Constitution and all that. But he has the right to speak. And speaking of that, I have seen stories of people who've been fired. Like there was a lady in New York, I think, that she was fired from her job because she said something in support of Hamas. And there was a dentist, I think, in Florida or somewhere who was fired because he was videoed. He was recorded taking down these posters that people have been putting up all over the country here in America of the Israeli people who have been kidnapped. So they have like a picture of the Israeli person and kind of an explanation, you know, 8-year-old kid kidnapped by Hamas, and the picture of the kid, and, you know, and some comments down below. And a lot of people don't like these. And I've seen them, for example, here in Hoboken, I saw some three or four that were taped to this phone booth, this public phone booth. And I know it's kind of like a strange thing to say nowadays, but they do exist. Every now and then you see one. But there's one nearby where I go to my lunch break, and I would see these posters of these Israeli hostages. And one day I went by and they got all torn down. So a lot of people are tearing them down. And what I'm trying to get at is this dentist, for example, got fired from where he was working because he was recorded taking down these posters. Now, I am not a supporter of Hamas by any stretch of the imagination. You know, cursed are they. Cursed are they, cursed are their families, cursed is anyone who supports them and embraces them, cursed are they. But my point is, why should my job be in jeopardy because of something I say that has to do with politics or anything like that, or world war, you know, world conflicts or anything like that? If I'm, for example, if I'm an engineer and I'm building bridges or whatever, why should the company that I work for have the right to fire me because I said something that was politically, quote, unacceptable to the company? Why? If my job has nothing to do with what I'm doing in my private life, that's not only a violation of the right to life, you know, which includes the freedom of speech, but it's also a violation of the other, the fifth fundamental human right, the right to a personal domain. I have the right to establish my own domain, my own kingdom, in my personal realm and personal space. And in that kingdom, I can say what I want. I should have the freedom. If I want to put up a website where I say all these things that are pertaining to my domain, to my understanding, and in this case, it's literally a web domain that you would be putting up, and you can say what you want there. It's the right to a personal domain. You know, as long as you don't, you're not like posting private information from other people, as long as you're not violating other people's rights, or let's say telling people how to kill 1,000 people in a shopping mall or something like that. As long as you're voicing your thought, and even that example I gave is kind of borderline. But the thing is, if I say I'm a Trump supporter, why should my company have the right to fire me because I'm a fascist and a bigot and all this other stuff that they label Trump as? And I'm not a Trump supporter, but I'm just giving the example. Or if someone supports Hamas, yes, he or she should be excoriated in the court of public opinion, but that has nothing to do with his or her job. So if I support Israel, should I get fired because supposedly Israel is, you know, this genocidal state that is killing all these Palestinians, you know, in that fantasy narrative that the liberals have? Why? Why isn't anyone passing legislation to protect the right to a personal domain? Why do I have to worry about what I say in public and having that affect my job? Unless, for example, if I'm working for an organization that is dedicated to promoting Jewish values or whatever. If I am found that I am saying I hate Jews, then obviously in that scenario, what I said is relevant. It's pertaining to my job description. Hence, it makes sense that they would no longer want my services there. That makes sense. But if I'm working at McDonald's, and then I go and somebody, one of my coworkers, sees me wearing a MAGA hat, which in my case, you know, you wouldn't find me, you wouldn't catch me dead with one. Not for the reasons that liberals have, because liberals, worthless bastards, they hate anyone who wears one of those hats, but it's for other reasons. But I wouldn't wear one. But what I'm saying in the example, if I supported him enough, I would wear it on purpose just to challenge anyone to try to take it away, take it off of my head. Like, go ahead, make my day. Take it off of my head, you worthless liberal bastard. Try to do it. And the judgment of the truth will be on you, and I'll be on you if you just dare to touch me and violate my right to speak truth. But the thing is that if I'm working at McDonald's and one of my coworkers sees me wearing a MAGA hat, and he comes and tells my supervisor, "Hey, so and so is wearing a MAGA hat," and that's bad publicity because it makes people think that we are all bigots. And why should I get fired? What does my MAGA hat have to do with making burgers? Why isn't anyone passing legislation? Why isn't anyone thinking about these things and protecting rights? No one is. Because we're living in a fantasy land. So that's the second set of things we wanted to talk about. First, people living in this world of disconnect, not realizing that the country is dead, and pretending that everything is okay, and still trying to work within the system that hates them and wants them destroyed. Defending the very system and upholding it without realizing that the system is against them. and not realizing that the whole thing is dead. You know, it's like having a cadaver. It's stinking up the place, and you're still thinking that the problem is you haven't opened enough windows, and that's why it stinks inside here. You know, that's the thinking, he's not dead. He's just sleeping. And because he's been sleeping for a while, he hasn't taken a shower, and that's why I kind of feel a bit of a smell every now and then when I go past him. But no, he's not dead. He's just sleeping, and he's so tired. He's been sleeping and not taken a shower for a couple of days. That's why the smell is, getting a little strong. But let me just open up a window. Maybe the fresh air will come and kind of wake him up from his slumber. That's the fantasy we're living in right now. And the second thing we've talked about is the freedom of speech and the right to life and the protection of rights and how some people are speaking out about it, but others are ignoring. But the people who have the power to make a tangible difference are refusing to, out of ignorance or out of just willful disregard for those rights. And no one cares, and no one is calling them out. Conservatives are not saying, Matt Gaetz, why aren't you doing this? Or Jim Jordan, why aren't you passing these legislations? You have the House, why don't you go ahead and do it? Oh, we don't have the Senate. Well, at least just give it, for crying out loud, just give it a try. Just have it pass the House and let the Senate reject it, and then let the American people, decide, but do something. Just don't just act like you have no power to do anything or that you don't care. So now we wanted to talk about this other story. This is related to something we talked about. And if you have been listening to these audio recordings, you may recall that at one point, as we were talking about the death of America, we felt prompted to talk about this German family that was that they were trying to deport, a family who came to America because they wanted to homeschool their kids, and in Germany that's illegal, and they were persecuting them, and they were threatening to take their kids away from them, and all this stuff, because homeschooling, I think, has been illegal in Germany since 1919, a year after World War I. And the thing is that there was an update on this story. This was posted on October the 14th on theblaze.com. The headline says, facing mounting pressure, the Bite Me administration deferred deportation of a devout Christian family who fled Germany. The matriarch told Glenn Beck, quote, prayers are powerful. It's interesting that they phrase it like that. The matriarch, in other words, the wife. It's a couple with their kids, but it's weird that they mentioned the matriarch, which is kind of creepy. The word matriarch. So it says, and I think it just speaks to the whole thing that's going on. It says a devout Christian family fled to the U.S. 15 years ago on account of its persecution by the German state. So it says, despite an initially successful asylum claim setting down roots in Tennessee, the O'Bastard administration saw fit to deracinate, I don't know what that means, the Homaica clan. The Bite Me family administration was set to follow through with the family's expulsion this month, but came up against significant opposition. A week after once again raising the alarm about the family's potential deportation, Blaze Media co-founder and nationally syndicated radio host Glenn Beck spoke to the Homaica matriarch about how she and her family have been granted a 12-month reprieve. That was a big relief, said Hannelore, I don't know how to pronounce her name, Homaica. We are very thankful. So then they keep say some other things, and then she talks about her gratitude for the American people who prayed and fought on our side. stressing the importance of prayer, a lesson she made sure to drive home when homeschooling her five children. And then she says, I also want to encourage the American people that the Lord hears their prayers, unquote. And quote, sometimes we get discouraged and we think, you know, maybe it's not enough. But prayers are powerful and we felt the effects. Now, one of the reasons why we wanted to mention or read this part of this article is what it says when you scroll down here. It says, the Bite Me administration nearly brought the Jamaica family's American dream to an end this week. And this is what I wanted to share with you. On September the 6th, following a month where 232,972 illegal aliens stole across the southern border, the family was informed during a routine check-in that their deferred status has been revoked. Accordingly, they were given 4 weeks to apply for German passports so they could be deported on October the 11th. What I wanted to mention is this. On when did they get the notification that they had to leave the country? On September the 6th. Why is that important? September the 6th was the day America died. And so it's like the day America died, they were told, you know, you've got to go. And we felt led to talk about this family in the context while we were talking about the death of America, when America was in the midst of dying. From the 6th to the 18th of September, as we've said several times. So it's not a coincidence, and this is a confirmation that the death of America happened on the 6th of September, and that's when they got the notification. But the thing is, you know, they've gotten a reprieve, so they will be allowed to stay for a while longer, but when you read the lady's comments, the German lady's comments, you get the impression she's not aware that America is dead. And, you know, just as she's saying, oh, when things look grim and dark, you have to keep holding on and praying. And I don't think she's heard the truth. I don't think she's heard the truth about the country. And she's still being positive about it. She's still saying, oh, you know, the prayers work. So all they got was an extension. They were not told, hey, you can stay. No, just hold on, because the Bite Me administration didn't like the publicity. It just said, okay, we'll let you stay for a while longer. But they are not aware that something has happened and that the country is dead. And I think that's why it's not a coincidence that this the headline says, the matriarch declared this. Because why did the country die? Because the Christians in America stayed under a matriarchal system. That's the root of it. And we are in a matriarchal society. And as we've said before, that has nothing to do with, you know, having women in power, literal women. It's figurative women, people who operate in the two female personalities of server and organizer, and who refuse to operate fully in the personalities of judge, visionary, and conqueror. And it starts with the American church. The American church should have, a Christian church should have broken the matriarchal system that it so faithfully clings to. And that's why America died. And this lady, why aren't they quoting the husband? I don't know, maybe the husband is dead. I don't know. But they don't make an effort to point out, you know, why is the, why is only the wife talking here? Why is the voice of the matriarch of the woman being emphasized in this article? And the woman saying, you know, just keep praying. You know, things look grim and dark, but if you pray hard enough, things are going to work out. And I'm not against that idea in general. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is there are certain things that you can pray all you want. It's not going to happen. America's dead. You can pray Christian, conservative Christianness, until you're blue in the face. America's not coming back to life. Why? Because the remedy to make it come back to life was in you, and you chose not to use it. You had the remedy, just like in, you know, when the virus stuff was happening. We had hydroxychloroquine. We have ivermectin. We had the medicines to treat anyone who who really got sick of the virus, but we chose not to use it. And that's why a lot of people died. And instead, we gave them remdesivir and put them on ventilators, which made things much worse because the virus was getting into their lungs much deeper. And that's how a lot of people died unnecessarily. We had the medicine to cure them. The few who got sick, who really got sick of the virus, but we just made it worse, and a lot of people started dying unnecessarily. And that's what happened. The American Christian Church had the medicine to cure the problem. It just chose not to use it. So they can pray to their God all they want. If you have the solution at hand and the truth has told you what to do and you refuse to do it, don't ask for another solution. It's like, I don't like this one. Give me something else. Give me something else. And you can pray until you're blue in the face. If you reject the real solution, then don't complain when things don't work out. So that's what I wanted to share. And again, I'm trying to read through the article here quickly, trying to see what happened to the husband. Why are they only quoting the wife? Is the husband dead? Where is he? But I think it points to this matriarchal thing, matriarchal theme. This woman and her family don't understand the country's dead. And it might actually even be a blessing in disguise if they return to Germany. But it's more, but you know, they love the country. They've established roots here. I understand them wanting to stay, but I don't think they realize that the party is over. The game is gone. It is done. So another thing we wanted to share, and we're running out of time, this, and so we're starting to talk more about Israel now. This headline on thecountersignal.com, that's the name of the website, thecountersignal.com. It was posted on the 11th of October, 2023. And the headline says, 8-year-old COVID vaccine poster child dies from heart attack. So maybe I'll be reading some things here. And please bear in mind, every time I say vaccine, I'm doing air quotes with my hands, if you know what I mean. So it says here, an 8-year-old boy from Israel has tragically died of a heart attack 3 years after appearing in a government-sponsored video that promoted the COVID vaccine for children. Jonathan Moshe Ehrlichman, suffering cardiac arrest while taking a bath. The child was taken to Hadassah Hospital in Mount Scopus, in serious condition, but died a few days later on September the 28th. And apparently he, I read some at some point here, the father saying that the kid got sick on the eve of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. That's when he went into cardiac arrest. And Yom Kippur apparently was started on the sunset of September the 24th. 2023. So that means that he had the heart attack between the 23rd and the 24th of September. And this, why are we mentioning this? Because this goes to what we were saying about Netanyahu and about the state of the condition of Israel. Israel was one of the most drastic violators of the human right to life, the freedom of speech, the freedom of movement, and all that during the lockdowns and all the nonsense. And they forced their population to inject themselves with this venom, you know, doing like a self-Holocaust, like a kind of combination Holocaust harakiri. And Netanyahu was behind this. Netanyahu is a dictator. He's a devious dictator. That's what he is. A conniving, manipulative dictator. That's what he is. If you want a description of him, that's what he is. And he enjoyed the power of controlling people and oppressing them. He just likes that. There's something sadistic about him. He is not a good person. Well, let me put it to you that he's not a quote good person. There's something very wrong with him. So it's fitting. That's why Israel, because Israel embraced all of this. It's just a manifestation of how Israel is just disconnected from the truth, arrogant, self-righteous, and that's why the veil of protection has been removed from them. And it's not a coincidence that shortly before the attacks in Gaza, which started, I think, on October the 7th, this kid died. And he died on the eve of Yom Kippur, which I think is the Day of Atonement. And Israel has no atonement. There's no atonement from the truth for Israel because Israel has remained in its arrogance. That's why this kid was 8 years old. 8 is the number of regeneration. Died, as if to say, your regeneration is dead because, and I will not atone you because of your arrogance and your stupidity and your willful blindness. And thinking that you have achieved all of this on your own, and you have never bowed to the truth. So we wanted to read that. And I feel no sorrow for the father. I kind of feel sorry for the kid to a certain extent because, you know, he's a kid. I mean, it's not like he was informed and reading websites and thinking. And, you know, he's just a kid. But I have no sorrow for the father because the father not only injected him, but used him as a way to get other kids to be injected and killed by it. Cursed is this father, have no mercy for him. He's one of those Jews that deserves the judgment that's coming to him. It's this judgment on him and his family. Cursed is he for having promoted this injection and killing his own child. That's what the Israelis were doing with this injection nonsense in Netanyahu. It's a self induced Holocaust. And the weird thing is, at the end of this section in this article, the next section suddenly shifts to something else. It says second in 2 years. Last year, Argentina's poster boy for childhood vaccination, air quotes, Santino Godoy Blanco, aged 4, tragically died after falling ill and reporting a plethora of symptoms. He's pictured on the Argentinian government's website under a vaccine campaign material guideline. Vaccines protect us, reads the slogan beside Blanco, who is holding up a fist. He's actually holding up two fists, but who's counting? Neither of these deaths have been linked to vaccines. Health Canada maintains that the COVID vaccine is safe and advisable for children over 6 months old. So it's interesting to me that this story features an Israeli kid who died and then an Argentinian kid who died. And as you may recall, when we were talking about in the previous audio recording about the attack on Israel and all that, we talked about the story of these 7 Argentinians who were amongst the killed by Hamas, Argentinians in Israel. And that's relevant because it's all connected. Israel has its protection removed. Why? And as its protection is removed, its biggest defender is no longer its defender. And who was that? America. The followers of the false Messiah, you know, according to them, the nation that has been the greatest follower in collective terms or statistical terms or whatever you want to describe it, in the history of mankind, no nation has been as close to being a follower of Yeshua than America. And America died in September, and why did it die? It died because it became like an Argentina. We've said this a million times. It will be known in history that the fall of America will be equated with the fall and decline of Argentina in the 20th century. The same thing happened, the same patterns, everything. So it's not a coincidence that the story features, you know, the death of an Israeli kid having been injected, along with, you know, the story of an Argentinian kid who got injected and got killed too. And I'm not sure if Godoy is a Jewish surname. I'd have to look that up. I have the slight feeling it is, but I'm not sure. So, because there are a lot of Jews in Argentina, by the way, a lot of Jews. And as I said, that's kind of ironic because that's where a lot of Nazis went to hide after the war. So we wanted to mention this story about Israel, this confirmation that there is a connection between how Israel behaved during the pandemic and what's happening to it right now, because that behavior showed Israel is disconnected from the truth and arrogantly following its own tune instead of following the tune of the truth. And another story we wanted to just very quickly mention, because we are running out of time, is this headline that I saw that led to this, took you to this Rumble video on rumble.com. And it's a long video by a fellow named Steve Bannon that some of you may know about. He's a very vocal conservative Trump supporter and all that. He was in the White House, I think, for a while, but then he got ousted. And Trump kind of turned his back on him. He still supports Trump, but Trump, when he should have defended him, really didn't. And that's Trump. What Trump is, you know, he will leave you hanging if you are not important enough to him. He will just use you to, you know, if you're promoting him, he will use you the way he used Sarah Palin. But he uses people enough, and then once he's done using them, he just says, okay, thank you very much, especially if they are going to bring controversy to him. He just says bye-bye and lets them go. And that's kind of what he did with Bannon. But Bannon is still a loyal supporter because, you know, we're living in Fantasy Island, living in this fantasy world where black is white is black, and it is... Black is white because I want it to be white, and white makes me feel good, so I'm going to stick to the idea that it's white. No, it's black. No, it's white. It's white. White makes me feel good. Black is too depressing. White is happy and makes me feel good, so I'm going to stick with that. So the reason why I was drawn to this video is the headline says that Bannon, quote, "We haven't done this since Casablanca and Cairo back in World War II. And I was trying to discern what exactly he was talking about. I listened to the beginning of the video, but then got really sick of hearing what I was hearing, and I had to stop. Because he started talking about, you know, how Bush, the warmonger Bush, who got us into Iraq and all that. So I go, oh, fantasy land. These people don't understand that the war in Iraq had a purpose. It got bungled by Bush, but the problem was not getting into the war, is how we proceeded after the invasion. We were not forceful enough. Instead of doubling down and backing out, we were supposed to go full throttle. And if we had gone full throttle, Assad would not be there. The Iranian regime would have been toppled. We would have an outburst of democracy in the region. A lot of the problems we have, a lot of the problems the Jews are having in Israel right now would not be happening if things had been done the right way. But this is an isolationist, a person who says, am I my brother's keeper? A person who doesn't understand that America had a responsibility to the world. That's why it was given so much to whom much is given, much is required of them. And he does not understand this. So he's still living in this world where he thinks that America is secluded, not responsible for what's happening in the world, is going to protect it, and that evil will not come to our shores And that's, you know, that's what happened on 9/11. It came to our shores because we didn't go out to take it out at the beginning. But there was a purpose in that 9/11 attack, because it led to the liberation of Iraq and Afghanistan. But then now those two countries are gone because we messed it all up. But the thing is, I don't know what he meant when he said, "We haven't done this since Casablanca and Cairo." He was criticizing Bite Me because he was snubbed by the King of Jordan and the Palestinian leader Abbas, that worthless bastard boy. They didn't even want to meet with him. Like, he's not important enough. That's how irrelevant America is now, because America is dead. And the only one who met with him was Netanyahu. And I go, "Netanyahu, don't you have some principle? Don't you have some character? Why are you meeting with this bastard and giving him credibility?" I would have said to him diplomatically, "Sorry, we don't have time to have you here. If you want to help us, that's fine. But you know how you can help us? You could have helped us by not leaving $80 billion worth of weapons to the Taliban, which are now, in the hands of a lot of those weapons are in the hands of Hamas terrorists killing our citizens. You enabled that. You want to help us. Don't come here. Kind of rectify what you did with the $80 billion of weapons. And also, our people are not very happy with you paying $6 billion in ransom to rescue five or six, I forget the number, of so-called, quote, American citizens being held hostage in Iran. A lot of that money is being used right now to kill our people. Our people are not very happy with you. Bite Me, please don't come." You know, no, but instead, Netanyahu is an opportunist, and as you may know, Netanyahu was very quick to congratulate Bite Me after the 2020 election. You know, the same guy who was buddy buddies with Trump and all that. Why did he do that? Because he said, "Oh, now the guy in power is Bite Me, so I have to go." You know, he went and got some lipstick and puckered up, and asked Bite Me to, you know, take down his trousers, and he, you know, gave him one big peck on the buttocks and said congratulations, because he wanted to ingratiate himself with the new person in, quote, power. That's how disgusting Netanyahu is. He pretends to be a man of principle. He is an opportunistic, deceptive dictator. That's what he is. And he should have never given any credibility to this Bite Me. He's the only one who met with him. Not even the King of Jordan, not even Abbas, wanted to meet with him. He's the one who decides to meet with him. How pathetic. And cursed is Netanyahu and anyone who supports him. The thing is that this is what Bannon was talking about, Bite Me being snubbed. But I don't know what he meant, but "We haven't done this since Casablanca and Cairo back in World War II. But it drew my attention because I'm still kind of puzzled by that linkage between Morocco and America. As we shared before, there was a big earthquake. I knew that when America died, it would be manifested in some form of some big earthquake. And then the earthquake in Marrakesh, and we talked about how that sounds like America and Morocco, America, Morocco. It's kind of, there's a similarity in the names. And there was this huge earthquake in Morocco, and I'm still puzzled by that connection. And I find it interesting that he mentioned Casablanca. "We haven't done this since Casablanca and Cairo back in World War II. And by the way, as some of you may know, Churchill and Polio Boy, FDR, met in Casablanca after they helped to, you could say, after the Allies forces kind of liberated that part of Morocco. And I guess that the people of Morocco more or less willingly embraced the Allies. So it was not like there was fighting to conquer the place. It was more or less, you could say, semi-peaceful takeover, kind of. And after that, Churchill and Polio Boy met in Casablanca to discuss certain things. I know there's a connection. I just still don't quite figure it out. But I know that Steve Bannon was, without meaning to, kind of saying things without understanding them, and kind of pointing out the connection between America's death and Morocco and Casablanca. We wanted to just mention that. And speaking of the prisoner exchange, let me just read this very quickly from left-wing website, usatoday.com. I remember as a kid when the USA Today came out, I always loved to read that paper because it was printed in big color. It was very colorful. You know, those days when you actually bought the physical newspaper. So I was a big fan of the USA Today when I was a kid, but it has turned into a very left-wing, liberal news outlet nowadays. So I'll probably have to wash myself after reading an article from them here. It says it was posted on the 18th of September, the final day of America's death, 2023. And it says, Iran releases five Americans in prisoner swap deal negotiated by Joe Biden. The deal comes ahead of a UN meeting in New York where Biden and Iranian hardline president will both speak. And it unfolds against a backdrop of nuclear tensions between the two countries. This was before the attack in Gaza, mind you. So there was already nuclear tensions going on, and these five Americans were released, but I don't know how American they are. I was trying to get a sense of, are these people legitimately worthy of being rescued? And I still not too clear about that. I don't think so. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. Because I try to look at who they were, let me just try to read some of the people here. Three of the American prisoners, I'm reading from the article, all dual U.S.-Iranian citizens are Siamak Namazi, Ahmad Sharghi, and Morad Tabaz. The identities of the two other Americans have not been released. A senior Biden administration official said those two Americans wish to keep their identities private. And also on the plane are Namazi's mother and Tabaz's wife, both of whom were previously unable to leave Iran. Namazi, 51, was arrested in 2015 while visiting his family in Tehran. Sharghi, 59, was detained in 2018, a year after moving to Iran from the U.S. to work for a tech investment company. Environmentalist Tabaz, 67, who also holds British citizenship, was arrested in 2018 while working on a conservation project in Iran. Now, it could be, and I could be wrong, that these guys were really spies, that they were going in there to do some work. And that's why they were there, and that's why they got arrested, and the whole thing. But I don't know. At least the environmentalist, he doesn't look like a spy, or doesn't feel like a spy. I think he's there to, you know, really do the conservation stuff. And I go, you know, if I'm an Iranian, and or having been born in Iran, I'd be, I don't know, I have this idea that I'd be more interested in the freedom of Iranian women and the protection of Iranian women's rights than in the protection of the Iranian home pigeon. You know, I don't know if that exists, but I'm just making something up. You know, I don't care about the Iranian home pigeon going extinct. You know, the world will not end if the Iranian home pigeon disappears from off the face of the earth. I'd be more interested in protecting the rights of Iranian women. You know, like that woman who was killed by the Iranian morality police for not wearing the face covering or the head covering the way they wanted it, her to. I'd be more concerned about that than about protecting the Iranian home pigeon. So the thing is that we paid all this money, ransom. It's ransom. I mean, they keep saying it's not ransom. Yes, it is. What the hell else is it when you pay money so that people are set free? I mean, what else is that? What do you call that? I know that nowadays, terms are what you want them to be. It's not what you see in the dictionary. It's what you want them to be. And if it's not what you want it to be, you just change the dictionary to read what you want it to read. But even so, I think technically this constitutes or fits the definition of ransom quite perfectly. So why are we doing this for these people? Why is this guy moving from Iran to the U.S. to work for a tech investment company? Is he really a spy? Is that why he was willing to go there and is infiltrating the system? But I don't think so. It doesn't ring a bell. A lot of people here were, they are thankful to bite me. And I don't think a person who is willing to fight for the freedom of Iran and sacrifice his life would be thankful to bite me. It just does not sound right, because bite me is about, he is just like his previous master, Obaster, a fan of Iran. It is sad, but the thing is that one of the reasons we wanted to mention this story is the fact that this story was posted on the day that America died. The day America died, final day of America's death, September the 18th, Iran releases five Americans, which is kind of ironic. It's almost, if you make the contrast, I remember when I was a kid, the Iranian hostage crisis in 1979, and I think it was 79, and it went into 1980, and then Ronald Reagan got elected, and shortly after Ronald Reagan got elected or went into office, I forget which, the Iranian hostages in the U.S. embassy were released. And that hostage situation was very embarrassing to Jimmy Carter, and it was part of one of the many things that led to him losing the election as badly as he did in 1980 against Ronald Reagan. So it's ironic, and that was the beginning of a partial rebirth of the country under Ronald Reagan, the greatest president in American history, which, as I always say, is a disappointing statement to make. It's like saying a 4 foot person is the tallest person in our family. And no disrespect to Ronald Reagan. He was a great man as a person, but, so president, but he was the best president we've ever had, which is so sad to say. I repeat. The thing is that, it's the contrast of he did it without paying a single cent. It's like, just, I don't know what he said to them, or they knew that, you don't mess with with cowboy Ronald Reagan. I don't know what happened, but they let the hostages go for free. And in this case, now that the contrast, that was the beginning of America's of an American rebirth from the stagnation and death of the Jimmy Carter years. And we've lived the consequences, the economic consequences of the Reagan years ever since then. I mean, the blossoming of the economy that has happened since then. We're still living out the effects, but obviously now America's going to die. The economy is slowly going to weaken and decline, just like Argentina's did in the 1900s. But the thing is that in the 20th century, but the thing is that it's the contrast. America was reborn. Hostages were released from Iran without paying a cent. America dies, and hostages are released but at a price to fund terrorism to go kill Jews and other other people, including Americans. So it's the contrast. And to save, see, the hostages in Iran in 1980, they were worthy of being rescued. Those were legitimate Americans being rescued. Now these are people who are Iranian Americans. If I'm an Iranian, I would not be caught dead in Iran unless I was there to promote insurrection. But otherwise, why would I go visit my family there? I'm out of here. I don't want anything to do with this evil culture, with this evil system. And if anything, I'd be fighting from the outside to help the Iranian people be free. But these people they don't sound or seem like real spies, but Tehran just grabbed them because they knew they could get money from them, and they did. Especially now that, because for example, the first guy who got kidnapped was in 2015, and who was in power in 2015? Guess who? Obastor in the White House, and they knew that Obastor would. Or they believed Obastor would yield, and Obastor didn't do anything. So the guys continued there. But what I'm trying to say is that they were kidnapped with hopes of getting something from them, especially because the people in power at the time were weak, internationally speaking. The other guy, Shargi, who was 59, was detained in 2018, a year after moving to Iran from the U.S. to work for the tech investment company, and who was president at the time? It was Trump. So I'm not sure why they got him. They also got the British American Iranian guy, the guy who's saving the Iranian pigeons, in 2018 when Trump was in power. But regardless, the thing is, the Iranians wanted them for money, and they got their money upon America's death. So it's not like a symbolic thing. Iranian hostages released when America died, contrast with Iranian hostages released for free when America had a partial rebirth. And the last thing we want to say, just to finish, and this is returning to the Israel theme, another story on Politico. I will have to watch myself because I read stories from Politico and USA Today. But this left-wing website has this story that says survivors of kibbutz attack turned their ire on Netanyahu. This was posted on October the 19th, 2023. It says a massive security failure and antagonism towards Palestinians means many Israelis think Netanyahu has to answer for Hamas attack. So there's a guy called Tomer Elias, a 17-year-old boy in the kibbutz of Nahal Oz, was forced to go door-to-door by Hamas to tell their neighbors to come out, saying he would be killed if they didn't. So they narrate his story. Couldn't care less. And then it says, now both in Belgium, he and someone else, they vented their frustration over what they saw as abandonment by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's divisive right-wing government, whose hostile policy towards Palestinians is accused of undermining Israel's security. He, Netanyahu, needs to say, I'm sorry. I failed you. It's because of me and my pride you were almost murdered, said Cherry, a 45-year-old Belgian Israeli health economist. The reason why I'm reading this is, yes, they are criticizing Netanyahu, who should be criticized, but they're criticizing him for the wrong reason. They're saying he's too tough on the Palestinians, and that's why the Palestinians are killing us. This is the mentality. It's my fault. It's our fault. It's our fault. We bring this on ourselves. Do you think so? That's why the covering over Israel is gone, because they are people who don't deserve protection anymore. These are self-genocidal people. These people are complaining that Netanyahu is too tough on the Palestinians. The same Palestinians who just almost murdered them. They are nice people. You know, they're not that bad. We're just provoking them into beheading babies and murdering old people and raping women and mutilating children. But they are nice people. We're just too tough on them, and we're too critical of them, and we just need to show more kindness and affection. This is a self-holocausting people. And that's what the state of Israel is. It's a state of self-holocaust. And that's why Israel is cursed. Cursed is Israel because it has rejected the truth. And it will remain cursed until it bends its knees at the truth and says, I acknowledge the truth and I repent for my stupidity and my self-righteousness. And that's why the curse is on Israel. Cursed is Israel, and it shall remain cursed until it bends its knees and recognizes the truth. And that's the last story. So in summary, we've been talking about how we're living in a fantasy world, and people living in Fantasy Island, not connecting to the truth, and where the freedoms that need to be protected are being spoken out by, declared by some, but the people who are in power are not, because of that disconnect with the truth. And then we talked about you know, this German lady, the matriarch, and how she got her eviction from America the day America died, but she doesn't understand that America is dead and still hopeful that America, through prayer, can be a happy place. And then we talked about you know, Israel committing self-genocide, the 8-year-old baby, you know, the poster child for the quote vaccine, dying of a heart attack, the Israeli kid, and then we also talked about briefly about the connection with Morocco, and America that is out there, but I still don't quite figure out what it is. And I know it's tied to the Middle East also. It's like there's something connecting all of this. America, Morocco, what's happening in Israel and Gaza in the Middle East. But I still don't quite figure it out. So we've talked about several kind of heterogeneous things, but I do believe there is a common theme, tying them all together, this disconnect from the truth, the people who can do something not doing what needs to be done, and on the other hand, the Israeli people deserving the judgment that is upon them. Thank you very much for listening.